Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm your host, Gabriela Santos, the Chief Market Strategist for the Americas here at JP Morgan Asset Management. It's become more than clear that we're living in an era of geopolitical volatility and that geopolitics needs to play a central role in how we think about the macroeconomic and investment outlook. I'm very excited to be joined today by Derek Chollet, the head of JP Morgan's Center for Geopolitics, to discuss this year's top of mind topics, such as the Iran war, as well as this decade's rewiring of economic competition, trade, technology, capital flows, energy, and security. Over his three-decade career, Derek has held various roles in government and has done prominent foreign affairs analysis. So he's the perfect person to speak to about how investors should understand the big geopolitical questions of our time. Welcome, Derek.
Great to be here.
So there's so much to talk about right now, so I'll just dive right in to all this year's hot topics. Of course, we're still here in the midst of the Iran war and the lack of a resolution so far. So what is currently your base case about how this all plays out?
Well, we're about where I expected us to be in the sense of we're in this extended and fragile truce period. Mm. I mean, the original truce is supposed to end in early or late April. Here we are in early June, and it's still a truce, even though the terms of the truce are not clearly laid out. And right now they're trying to negotiate an extension of the truce. And even if there is a negotiated extension of the truce, which the U.S. is driving hard to try to get done, I do foresee that we're going to be wrapped up in the drama of Iran for quite some time. I mean, even the best case scenario is it's going to take weeks and really months for the Strait of Hormuz to get back open, even in a partial way. And so I expect, and our colleagues who study energy and commodities here at JP Morgan will say, it's we're looking at $4 to $5 gas prices per gallon for the next for the rest of the year. And even if the best case scenario comes through, we're going to see a 30% opening of the straits in the next few weeks. But that's the best case scenario. There's a likelihood this could go on still for a while. I mean, the one thing the Iranians are quite adept at is stringing out negotiations, right? And you've seen the U.S. and the president get frustrated by that. And so they're playing this. They're going to play this out, I think, for quite some time. So, I mean, my base case in the near term is we're going to see we've seen an Iranian regime that's hardened, that's smaller, right? It's somewhat weaker because, of course, it took a pretty severe pounding by the U.S. and the Israelis in this air campaign. But it's got some tools that it's playing. It's got some leverage that it is using. And so in the near term, I think we need to expect a hardened regime and a pretty defiant regime. The question in my mind is what happens 1, 2, 3 years out from now? And that's where I can see different trajectories.
And in of course, for the markets, the all-important opening of the Strait of Hormuz, even partially, would be
some relief.
Some relief and kind of the consensus anyway at this point. How do you think other Middle East countries have internalized this experience and the kind of Iran they're dealing with going forward and how that can shape the energy market?
Well, it's interesting. It's on the one hand, it is certainly, I think, hardened views across the Middle East, particularly the Gulf, about Iran, right? I mean, Iran has not gained any friends in this whole episode. And Iran attacking every Gulf country, including Oman, who's arguably its best friend among the Gulf, will never be forgotten. But there is a question and a debate within the Gulf about, therefore, what do you do about it? On one end of the spectrum, you've got the United Arab Emirates have taken a pretty hard-line position against Iran. They've consistently been hard-line, but really deepening ties with the Israelis, deepening ties with the United States, really doubling down on their own defense, and also doubling down on the workarounds around the Strait of Hormuz and really investing in pipeline that's already there, but also other pipelines. You've got Saudi, which is, of course, the big behemoth of the region in terms of just size and throw weight, that is certainly not a friend of Iran's right now, but probably thinking about ways that maybe let's try to reach a detente with this with this hardened regime, right? So it's not about any kind of reconciliation, but it's about can we just find a way to coexist in some ways, even if we fundamentally don't like one another. I think what you're going to see in the Gulf, you're already seeing it, is a doubling down on defense And defense spending in the Gulf has been a constant over the last 10 years or so. We're going to see, I think, a big spike in defense spending in the coming years as the Gulf seeks to harden themselves further. And then greater redundancy in the energy systems. And we're already seeing this with pipelines, trying to make the Strait of Hormuz less relevant in some ways. You're never going to make it 100% irrelevant, but make it less of a choke point. Mm. The challenge will be for countries like Qatar, which, of course, their major energy exports LNG. 15-20% of their LNG has been taken offline. That could be offline for years, given the repairs that need to happen. And it's you can't move LNG with pipelines. So it's going to be a harder issue for a country like Qatar to manage. But I think overall, what you're seeing in the region is a hardening positions against Iran, although an understanding that if Iran isn't going anywhere, the regime's not going anywhere, they have to maybe find a way to accommodate. Yeah. And then in some instances, particularly in the Emirates, a doubling down of the relationship with the Israelis and the Americans. Mm.
And there's been also, of course, another ongoing war amidst all of this, the war in Ukraine.
Right.
What is the end game there? Right. I mean, it's been years.
Well, in just the last week, we've seen an intensification of that war as Russia's been launching some brutal attacks. They've been notable just even in the 4 years of brutal attacks. Mm. Just the last few days have seen some pretty significant attacks on Kyiv and other major cities in Ukraine. Look, I think the sense is that Russia is it's in a weakened position today. It is having a harder time with this war, obviously, than it anticipated, and that Ukraine has shown itself to be not just resilient, but quite effective, particularly in its innovation and use of drones against Russian military. So that the end game could be near, right? And that in some ways, the Russian intensification of the campaign against Ukraine and Russia's threats against NATO states and possibly widening the war, which I don't think is likely to happen, but there's more concern about that, is an effort by Putin to gain some leverage, to gain an upper hand, to enter into a negotiation. Mm. We just put out a report a few weeks ago at the Center for Geopolitics here at JP Morgan to assess where we are in Ukraine and the end game that we think that we could be in when it comes to negotiations with Ukraine. There's a couple reasons for that. One of that is the support for Ukraine that's in Europe, also still here in the United States in terms of helping make sure that Ukraine maintains its resilience and its ability to defend itself. It's putting a pathway for Ukraine and its greater integration with Europe in particular. Those sorts of things can give Ukraine the confidence to come to some sort of deal. It's not going to be a resolution of anything, but something that could bring to an end to the fighting. The key question here, though, is Putin. And it's easier for me to see a way that Ukraine could get to an agreement, but it's harder to see how Putin would get there. But it could be that given the damage that is being done to Russia and to particularly its military, by some estimates, 30,000 Russian casualties just last month in May.
Wow.
Russia lost ground last month in May, more so than it has in several years, that Putin may be looking for a way out and looking for that off-ramp. So that's what I think is going to be tested in the coming months.
Mm. And for our partners, our allies in Europe, in Asia, how have the experiences of these two ongoing conflicts and just the perception of America as an ally changed?
Sure. And that's, I think there's been a couple geopolitical shocks that have all happened in the last few years. And the reason why I think this moment, 2026, is somewhat unique in recent history is we have this confluence of geopolitical shocks all happening at once. So you've got the largest land war in Europe since World War II, which has been raging for 4+ years. You have a regional war in the Middle East that one way or another has been underway since October 7th, 2023. So we're almost in our third year of that war. You then have the rise of China as a major global player economically, militarily, politically. So and then, by the way, you have a revolution in technology.
Yes.
In a way that the world has not seen, perhaps even since the Industrial Revolution. So the combination of those things makes this geopolitical moment particularly fraught, which is why it's so much on the minds of our clients. Mm-hmm. I think for Europe, what they see is, first, the return of the potential for great power war on the European continent. I mean, we are, again, largest land war since World War II, but this idea that Russia could pose a threat to Western Europe, to Eastern Europe, is something that is not just a theoretical issue. It is something that European friends in Poland and the Balts and Southern Europe deal with every day, right? In terms of Russia. Yeah. Just a week ago, Russian drone hit apartment building in Romania, right? I mean, this is a real threat. You also have the rise of China and greater concerns about China in Europe, European reliance on China for critical minerals and rare earths, China throwing its weight around in the international system more than it has in the past. So that's something that's kind of focused European minds. But then also uncertainty about the United States. Mm-hmm. There's been lots of questions going back, not just in the last year, but over the last several years about U.S. commitment to Europe. Is the U.S. care more about the Middle East or more about Europe, or care more about Asia or more about Europe? Questions about U.S. military presence on the ground, questions about U.S. commitments to NATO. When I was in government, we dealt with a lot of these challenges and questions. They're still very present today, and they're more probably, they're sharper today in terms of these questions. So Europe is worried, right? They see challenges kind of coming at them from every direction, right?
Yeah.
And so there's certain things that are manifesting in Europe that I think are pretty interesting. I mean, you're seeing a lot of defense spending in Europe, and that's been a kind of a generational shift, it seems to me. A lot of reasons for that. We have Vladimir Putin to thank for that. We, I think, have the United States to thank for that in terms of not just our arguments, but uncertainty about the U.S. is driving a lot of the defense spending in Europe, and I think that's going to sustain. There's also greater European consensus today than, say, there was 10 years ago about China and concerns about the concerns about China in the sense of the direction it may be taking in the international system. Obviously, European countries, European companies, European clients do business with China just as Americans do. But in terms of thinking through the reliance on China for things like critical minerals and rare earths, for the way that China is playing in some cases in European politics, that's something that is I'm hearing more and more from European leaders and colleagues.
And do you see Europe taking action?
I do. I mean, I think, look, it's been sort of a easy thing to for Americans in particular over the years to say, well, Europe can't get its act together. And there's a lot to be worried about. And for clients who read Jamie Dimon's shareholder letter, he spends a good chunk of it at the very end talking about his both ambitions for Europe and what he wants to see in Europe, but also his concerns about Europe and where Europe is today. And the fact that only a handful of the several hundred recommendations of the Draghi report have actually been implemented. So that's a cause for concern. But I think, particularly when I look at it from a military and defense perspective, I do see a shift in Europe. And I think that shift is meaningful and it is lasting in terms of Europeans being able to deliver. But Europe, like the United States and many other parts of the world, has a lot of dysfunctional politics right now. Yeah. And, you know, the U.K., I was just in London a few weeks ago and, you know, everyone was asking, when is Keir Starmer going to leave, right? I mean, there's the sense of just turmoil there. We have a big French election coming up next year. Germany, Chancellor Merz came into office last year, but, you know, his polling numbers are pretty low right now. There's lots of questions about him moving forward. I think he's fine. But the bottom line is there's just a lot of churn and uncertainty politically in Europe today, which is going to make doing some of these big things even harder.
But once you've got the Germans actually spending a little bit more, there's clearly a psychological change.
Absolutely. I think we've seen that sort of paradigm shift on the continent. Yeah. The question now is, how are they going to actually implement this, right? Because particularly when it comes to defense spending, okay, Germany can, they got lifted the debt brake, right, which allows them to go into debt for defense spending. But it's going to mean trade-offs on social services and in terms of how they try to pay for some of this defense spending.
Yeah. You mentioned, of course, China in this big power competition, U.S., China. What did we learn from the recent President Trump, President Xi meeting over in Beijing about the status of that?
Yeah, well, I think truce is a common theme. I think we're an extension of the truce, the trade truce in this instance, between the U.S. and China that was a result of a meeting the presidents had last year. And look, I think both sides got out of this summit what they wanted. For President Xi, it was the President of the United States coming to Beijing, paying respect. It's interesting, President Xi's not left China since last October. He's hosted 20-some world leaders in China since then. And of course, President Trump was there. And then a couple days later, President Putin was there, right? And so sort of this parade of senior officials Chancellor Mertz has been there. Keir Starmer's been there. Mark Carney's been there. Like, they're all, everyone's going to China, right? Mm-hmm. And so China definitely got that. They also were able to frame the U.S.-China relationship in a way and got the U.S. to embrace this framing of a constructive strategic stability, a relationship leading to that, which getting the U.S. to buy into that was important, because now if there's any ripples in that, if there's anything that comes up, for example, regarding Taiwan or trade or technology or U.S. military operations in the South China Sea, the Chinese could say, well, wait a second, that's not constructive nor contributing to stability, right?
Yes.
So we'll kind of, the key thing is not that the U.S. embraced it, it's that how was each side defining that kind of phrase. On Taiwan, the Chinese side probably did not get what it wanted in terms of there was no change in the U.S. position, but there's a discussion right now in Washington about the future of a major U.S. arms sale to Taiwan. And the president left the summit saying he's going to be thinking about if he's going to move forward on that or not. President Xi is going to be coming to Washington for a reciprocal summit in September. So because of that, I think there's a incentive for both sides to kind of keep things on the rails between now and September. But it also means some of these issues, whether it's on Taiwan or technology transfers or on trade, and President Trump this summer, the Section 301 investigations on trade will be concluding. So there'll be a question of, is he going to do anything further with tariffs and trade with China? A lot of that, all of those could be disruptive to what both sides would hope to be a successful summit in September. So I think for clients, kind of keeping that in mind, that we'll have another big moment in the third week of September when President Xi will come to Washington. And then there could be two other presidential meetings this year, both on the margins of the APEC summit that President Xi is going to be hosting in the fall, and then President Trump will be hosting the G20 summit in Florida in December. And so it's been nearly 20 years since the U.S. and Chinese presidents have met four times in 1 year. And so it's not unprecedented, but it is unusual that they meet that often. Again, that provides some stability in the relationship, because my experience, at least, is that usually the U.S.-China relationship goes off the rails when the two sides aren't talking at high levels, but it's not necessarily a guarantee that they're going to certainly agree on everything. And the challenges that were in this relationship, the structural differences between the U.S. and China that existed prior to the summit a few weeks ago, still exist today. So I sort of think of the summit as a dose of diplomatic Advil. It made people feel better, right? And things were calmer, but it didn't address the underlying condition.
And speaking of the underlying condition, of course, it's, you know, the choke points that each side control.
Right, exactly.
You know, the U.S. with cutting edge technology, which is such a big part of this, and China with critical minerals.
Right.
What do you see each side doing to kind of try to break that hole?
Well, they're both trying to break the hole.
Yeah.
I mean, and the U.S. is, and this is something, by the way, that J.P. Morgan is part of through our Security and Resiliency Initiative here, which is to try to help U.S. companies and companies from allies and partner countries to build greater resilience in our supply chains. It's not just about China. It's about about the world in general, making sure that there are more reliable sources of some of these critical minerals and rare earths out there. I think one of the big wake-up calls for the United States last year was how exposed the U.S. was. I mean, 80-90% of some of the imports of these rare earths and critical minerals, you kind of go through the periodic table, and pretty much all of them, 80-90% is sourced from the PRC. And those go to everything from your iPhone to the most sophisticated missile that the U.S. military has. And so that's a fixable problem. And so addressing that is something the U.S. is doing. And there's a critical role that the private sector is going to have to play here and is playing here. But the same is true in Asia as well as in Europe in terms of allies understanding what their supply chains look like and making sure that those are as resilient as possible. On the other side of it, China is also looking to build.
They're not going to stand still.
They're looking to build their resilience, right? And one of the things on the president's agenda at the summit was to move forward on a sale of high-end semiconductors to China. But the Chinese haven't taken us up on that, the U.S. up on that yet. And there's a lot of speculation about why that is. And one of the reasons perhaps is that they think they're close to building something indigenously that is close enough to what the U.S. has to offer that they don't want to buy it from the U.S. Mm-hmm. So I think this is something also we're seeing more broadly geopolitically, and this is not the stuff of headlines that are going to push notifications on your phone. Yeah. These are things that are more slow moving that we may, when we sit down together in a few years, we will look back and say, oh, wow, that has totally shifted. And that's this, what I think of as the rewiring of the global system.
Mm-hmm. I did want to make
these,
sure we get
to these supply chains, these, yeah. you know, yeah. where the global trading system, right? Where, yeah. you know, the in many ways, the driver of the late 20th, early 21st century global trading system in the United States has fundamentally changed its approach, yeah. right? And yeah. but just as the U.S. is kind of going back to the future in a way, right, in terms of pursuing a trade policy and imposing tariffs that is, we haven't seen anything like it since the 1930s in terms of just the overall global tariff rate.
Yeah,
the rest of the world isn't following suit. The rest of the world, I mean, there was last year was a record-breaking year in terms of trade deals. Mm-hmm. Countries like India have been inking trade deals left and right. The EU brought to closure a trade deal that had been in the works for years with Latin America, with Mercosur, with South American countries, Mercosur. So, you know, the U.S. may be pulling back from trade, but the rest of the world isn't. And that's going to have, I mean, that has real-world effects today, but I think over time, that kind of rewiring of trade, of supply chains, mm-hmm. will have an impact. Now, there's upside opportunities for sure. But there's also a lot of risk built into that as well.
And you've written a lot about this. You know, this isn't just U.S.-China or the war in Ukraine or Iran war. Let's zoom out. There's really this rewiring that's happening. You've written a lot about it with the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. Is there something you think investors are underappreciating around this rewiring? We talk a lot about how it could drive inflation, how there are more supply-side shocks. Is there something we're missing?
I don't think, I mean, in my conversations with clients, investors, it's not, I might say there's a pretty sophisticated understanding of these changes as they happen day to day. I think the issue that I find is maybe underappreciated, but I think it's to be fair, it's underappreciated by all of us because it's hard to see in the moment, is kind of how lasting this restructuring is going to be. I think sometimes there's a sense of, well, this is sort of a moment and then we're going to go back to where things were before. And I just don't see that happening. Like, I don't see the U.S. fundamentally changing its approach to trade from here in the near term or the medium term.
Yeah.
Right. I think, you know, Joe Biden was the first U.S. president since the 1930s, to not pursue a trade deal anywhere. And so there's not a constituency I see in the Democratic side for, like, going back to where things were. So my sense is, and we wrote another report on trade, kind of the global trade outlook and the U.S. approach to trade, which we'll be updating this summer, that I think where we end up on trade kind of at the end of President Trump's second term is more or less where we're going to be for a while as the United States. And I think sometimes that's not necessarily baked into thinking, because there's a thought that this is just a function of a particular administration, where I think it's something much more fundamental.
There's a clear generational shift that's happened here.
I think so.
You have just celebrated the one-year anniversary of the Center for Geopolitics here at J.P. Morgan. What surprised you the most about some of these client discussions you've been having?
Well, I would say it's a happy surprise, which is we have very engaged clients. We have clients who are incredibly sophisticated, who are their own geopolitical experts in many ways, right? And you know, my job is to wake up in the morning and go to bed at night thinking about geopolitics. And obviously our clients are thinking about growing their businesses or making their communities succeed or making their investments be successful. And geopolitics is part of that, but it's not the only part. But I find that there's been in the first year that we have been up and running, there's an insatiable appetite for understanding what's going on in the world, and that's that actually to me gives me some confidence, because This is not a community, our broader client community, and I think the same would be true for other institutions. That's heads in the sand. You know, that's pretending it's all going to go away. It's engaged. It is sophisticated. I'm trying to understand what's going on so they can make better decisions, and that's what we're here for.
Yeah, it's clear there's a permanence to it and also a market impact.
Absolutely,
that's important.
Yeah.
How did you first get involved in geopolitics?
Oh well, you know, I was in college during a pretty critical moment in world history. This is dating myself, but I started college in 1989, and November of my freshman year, the Berlin Wall fell. And we thought, you know, history had ended in 1989, right? The Cold War was over, the U.S. won. Then in the summer between my sophomore and junior year, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August of 1990. And then at the end of 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed and broke apart into constituent republics. And so there was a sense of momentous history being made in that period. And that's for many people, I'm sure, in college, you're sort of, that's when your mind is its most most sort of impressionable. I grew up in Nebraska. I didn't grow up really thinking about the broader world. I was always interested in U.S. government, U.S. politics. But then during that time, I really got interested in geopolitics and then started a career, then been in and out of the U.S. government my entire career since then, working at the State Department, at the White House, at the Pentagon, at Capitol Hill. And so it's been a real privilege for me to be here at J.P. Morgan over the last year plus now, working with our clients, trying to help them navigate what is unquestionably one of the most challenging and interesting geopolitical moments anyone of us has ever lived through.
And I'm always really impressed at your and your team's ability to translate all of these complex topics into something bite-sized but actionable and with real insight. If folks want to read a little bit more about it, where can they find your work?
So if you go on the J.P. Morgan website and you search for geopolitics, you will find our landing page for clients who have access to Morgan Markets. We have a page on Morgan Markets as well, where all of our materials are there. And just reach out and come find us. And so we try to put out reports for everything we do is for clients, but we do put out reports for the broader public as well. They'll be on our website. But we try to have as wide a distribution as we possibly can, and we try to write things both in terms of the topics we're covering as well as the way we cover them and the way we talk about them in ways that are accessible, useful, and impactful for clients as they're trying to kind of add this as an input into their thinking as they're trying to make decisions about their investments or their businesses.
And a bonus round, if you had to pick one of your 8 books that you've authored or co-authored, which one would it be?
Well, it depends. If you're looking for a cure to insomnia, many of my books would be an apt cure for insomnia. But I would say the one that is kind of the deepest cut, right, in terms of it's kind of more reflective of the way I think about the world and. It's not about me, but it's about 3 U.S. presidents, Dwight Eisenhower, George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, and Barack Obama, the last of whom I've had the privilege to work for. And it's a book about their presidencies and the way that they looked at the world. It's called The Middle Way. And it's about their foreign policy strategies, the challenges they face, their successes, their failures, as well as the politics and the political debates about each of their foreign policies, which was striking because they're 3 pretty dissimilar guys, if you think about it, Ike, Bush 41, and Obama. But they have a strikingly similar outlook on the world, and they faced very similar political forces in the 1950s, the late 1980s, early 1990s, and the 2008 to 2016 period. So it was interesting to me to explore, but it was a book that came out in January of 2021, so it was kind of high COVID.
I was
going into the administration, so I did 0 publicity for it. So I think it's well down the millions in Amazon. So you know,
well, we'll do it now, right here, exactly. The Middle Way. Thank you so much, Derek.
We really appreciate it. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us for another episode of J.P. Morgan Asset Management's Insights Now. We hope you join us next time.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.